as a reporter. Again, welcome. This is the third session of the CAPTCHA course, and in coaching calls, you guys have impressed Kate and I enormously. We're really pleased with everybody's progress. I'm now going on to this. Oh, I got the wrong PowerPoint up. I'm going on to the second slide, which is today's agenda. We got a few follow-up items. We're going to talk about resident assessment. We're going to talk about staffing, have Q&As, and then assignment and next teleconference. On to the third slide. This is a, you're looking at here, a form that I sent you by email. It's also available on our website. This is one of the last forms we're going to be sending your way. This is, for us, really important because it lets us know how you're doing and helps us evaluate the course in terms of, you know, is it making a difference at the resident level? And on here, we're asking you to report four pieces of information for each resident that you assess in a prompted voiding trial, a two- or three-day trial, and in the resident interview. And the items reflect right back to the prompted voiding assessment card. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. We want you to tell us how they did on their three-day trial, if they were pleased with the increased toileting assistance that they received, whether they liked to receive toileting assistance, and whether you're planning to maintain them on prompted voiding, on scheduled toileting, on check and change, just sort of the outcome on how you plan to manage after all the assessments that we've recommended. Let me know in an email, a phone call, if you have any questions about this form. Going forward, we're going to ask you to fill one out each time you assess a resident. Right now, you're going to have to go back and fill one out for any residents you've assessed in the last couple of months. And then fax it back to me, mail it back to me, scan it, and email it back to me, whatever works for you. And again, let me know if you've got any questions on that. That was kind of quick, but again, I'm available. I want to get to the heart of it. I'm on now the fourth slide with Jack. He's going to address a few follow-up questions that we had in coaching calls, and we'll try to leave time at the end of this for some more questions. Jack?
All right, thank you. So the two questions that we received from somebody since the last time were listed on your screen. The first one is, how do you manage residents with catheters, and are they considered in common? So let's take the, are they considered in common first, because the answer to that one is yes and no, I think. It's no if the MGS, particularly the new one, they put a separate blank for when somebody is on a catheter, a urinary catheter, they don't ask you to check the urinary incontinent categories and how frequently they're incontinent. I think what that probably means is that it's not going to be considered in the quality indicator reports, like the number of people incontinent in your facility, the number of people incontinent without a toileting plan. It'll still be looked at separately. But the answer to the question is also yes, because I have a lot of experience with the survey process. My experience with the survey process is that if they're going to investigate incontinence, they almost certainly will include catheters in investigation of that, in their investigation. And they do it all together. Deficiencies for the two are somewhat the same. So saying that, how do you manage residents with catheters? That actually would probably be at least a 10-minute talk. So today I'm not going to give the complete 10-minute talk. I'm going to tell you the most important thing I think you should do for management, for documentation purposes, for the survey process. And then later, when we have more time in a different session, I'll expand on how to manage catheters. Anyway, here's my experience with watching surveyors in a bunch of different states. The primary thing that they write deficiencies for catheters, if there's not very good documentation, explicit documentation of why somebody has one, it's not enough just to say that somebody had one on a mission and that you didn't put it in. They want a clinical justification for it. The clinical justification that they are taught to look for is whether somebody has overflow incontinence retention, which means they just can't void, then that's justification for a catheter. They have a stage 4 pressure ulcer that won't heal, that's justification. And if they're on end-of-life care, and if the patient's preference, probably some other justifications as well. But the point is, you better have something there. A line or two for anybody who has a catheter about why they have it, a clinical justification. I would ask the patient's physician or medical doctor to do that, to be safe. In addition to that, they look at a bunch of other things too, but those are pretty specific and pretty explicit. And I'll focus my attention on that in the next couple of weeks. The second question that was asked is that some residents are offended to be asked if they are wet, and should we forego this question or substitute another question? So my answer to that quickly is, if they're offended, you probably shouldn't do it. But, I mean, I'm a little surprised at that, because let me tell you the rationale. I mean, the whole rationale of asking them if they're wet or dry is to avoid the even more embarrassing care, I think, more embarrassing care, of actually either checking them to see if they are wet or dry, or starting the changing process. And then as you do the changing process, you find out they're dry, and you don't complete the changing process. So that's a lot more invasive, in my view, than simply asking them whether they're wet or dry. The goal of it is that a lot of people can be brought to be very accurate about that question. I mean, they can tell you, I mean, if you say, are you wet or dry, they can tell you, and they're accurate. And if they're accurate and they say they're dry, you don't have to check them. I mean, you don't have to go through the next much more obtrusive and labor-intensive step of checking and changing undergarments. If you know that they're accurate and you know they'll be accurate after a while, after that 2 or 3 day trial, you know, doing that. So that's the purpose of it. It's to avoid the even more embarrassing act of changing somebody. I guess just subtle tips. I mean, I'm assuming that most of the prompting that you're doing and checking and changing and toileting are being done in relatively privacy in the patient's room. So I assume that the patient's roommate or some maybe visiting family members might be there. If that's the case, I would still ask the question, but I would do it quietly, close to the patient's ear, and, you know, with the curtain closed and all the other things. If that's still not enough, if the patient's still embarrassed by it, if they don't like the question, just don't do it. It's not important enough to do it. Long run, it should save you a lot of time, and it should avoid even more embarrassing types of care. But obviously, we don't tend to do anything if an individual patient reacts in such a way as to indicate that they don't like it. And that answers that question. I suppose that, Annie, we can take questions about that, not now, but after, right? Because we don't want unmeeting to go on, do we? I'll go on. I don't think she wants to unmute. Any more questions for your set? Let's ask them later. Let's go on to the next slide. The next slide is one of the purposes of today's presentation is to talk about assessments for continence that are required by the survey guidelines, and I'm going to try to make that more specific and talk about what assessments I think are most important. Not only most important in the sense that it will actually act on it and probably do something good for the patient, but I think also most important for the survey process. The survey process in general, with the new incontinence guidelines and the new quality survey, breaks things into four areas. Breaks it down into assessment, care plan revision, those are the four areas. And each one of those four areas have a bunch of things they ask surveyors to look for. Assessment has the most. Assessments for incontinence. And when you're supposed to do them, this is the next slide. When you're supposed to do them is at admission, or when there's a change in the resident status, namely, you know, if they go to the hospital, in your facility, they go to the hospital for continence and come back incontinent. And most of the important assessments that they recommend that you do, and the most clinically important ones, really can be done during that 3 day trial that you're doing to determine whether people are good for a toileting program or not. Next slide is what to assess. Sorry, up to him.
No, I think that's right.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, my screen just jumped in. What to assess? I'm I'm listing things on this slide that are explicitly listed in the new incontinence guidelines for the quality computer survey and for the standard survey too. You're supposed to assess a resident's preference for what they want, their prior history of incontinence. You're supposed to do a medication review for medications that might influence urinary incontinence. Aricept is one of the new ones that a lot of people are using that does have effects on urinary incontinence. It increases, increases the frequency of it. Voiding patterns, the pattern of fluid intake, and a pelvic rectal exam. I put a little star by preferences, and I put a little star by voiding patterns, because I think those are the two, in this list here of six, those are the two areas that surveyors are most attentive to. And in the case of preferences, it's one of the more important ones. Now, what we don't have on that slide, and which Annie's going to send after this presentation, is a list of basically seven more areas. There's a lot of assessments that they specify in these interpretive guidelines that surveyors are supposed to look like, and by implication, you're supposed to do. The other ones that you're supposed to do is that you're supposed to have a description of the resident's functional and cognitive abilities as it influences the urinary incontinence and the type of assistance required by the residents. What they're talking about here is they want some description somewhere that you're attentive to the fact that the resident needs physical assistance to get to the toilet, one person assist, two persons assist, whatever. They like you to list the diagnoses that might be related to urinary incontinence. They like you to do a skin exam in the perineal area, because that might be influenced by urinary incontinence. They'd like you to describe the type of incontinence. They'd like you to do a post-voiding residual if the resident is at risk. They'd like you to say, do a urine culture or explain why you didn't. They have to look at environmental factors that might influence urinary incontinence. What they're most attentive to environmental factors really is whether the call bell is within reach. The ones that I just listed are most important, that the ones that I've seen the most deficiencies written about, are the functional cognitive issues, the type of incontinence that a person has, and I'll talk about those in just a minute in a little bit more detail. The next slide, resident preference and choice. I think this is the most important one to attend to. They're basically asking now in the survey process, particularly the new QIS, is to whether care or the intervention that a resident is receiving for anything, whether it be nutrition or incontinence, whatever, does it reflect their choice? The other terms or words they have in the survey guidelines throughout the survey guidelines are called individualized care. Let me start off by saying that prompted voiding is the absolute perfect example of individualized care or choice. Now, somebody asked a question as well last week. It wasn't on that first slide, Annie said. What is the difference between scheduled toileting and prompted voiding? There's only one difference. In scheduled toileting, you basically go to the patient on some predetermined schedule, every 2 hours, hour and a half, whatever. And you provide toileting assistance. There's nothing in a scheduled toileting regimen that says that you're supposed to ask the resident if they'll try to use the toilet. There's no prompting, in other words, in a scheduled toileting program. At least there's no protocol for it. The way we're trying to do this is we're saying go to a patient every couple hours, just like scheduled toileting, but unlike scheduled toileting, ask them if they're wet or dry, and then ask them if they'll try to use the toilet and prompt them up to three times. That's resident choice. That's a perfect example of resident choice. I mean, a resident has the choice, will say, yes, I'll try, no, I won't. That's exactly what those guidelines are trying to get at. Individualization, or the patient's individualizing their own schedule. They don't have to use the toilet, I presume they'll tell you they don't, and you don't take them. That's individualized. So it's the most explicit, clear example of how a intervention, how a care routine is both individualized and based on resident choice that there can be. Now, you can't do any better, you know, than asking the patient each time that you provide care and try to follow up on whatever they say, you know, their preference. The key is that if you're doing prompt avoiding to avoid having any problems with this particular survey guideline is whether this procedure you're using is consistent with your preference. It's very important that you just don't say you're going prompt avoiding, because some surveyors don't have a good understanding of what that means. I think you need to use specific language that reflects the fact that prompt avoiding means you're prompting every 2 hours and only take them if they say they want to go. And I'll give you language the next time. The next time that we meet, I think we have a particular session on the survey process. So I'll give you some examples of explicit language that you can put in the chart about prompt avoiding, which meets the heart of the guideline, that you're implementing a program that's perfectly consistent with the resident's choice or preferences. So this brings up the question, if a resident is on a check and change program, is that okay? Well, the answer to that question is yes, but there has to be good documentation that something better, something that doesn't promote higher level of functioning, which, you know, with clothing programs, how they consider that, that something like that won't work. And that's why you're doing that 3-day trial. If you do that 3-day trial and the patient does poorly on that 3-day trial, they don't get dry, they don't pull it, and you know, at the end, we're supposed to get the preference anyway. If the patient says, okay, that's okay with me for check and change, it's impossible to consider or to conceive of how it wouldn't be a perfectly good individualized program for that patient to be on a check and change program rather than prompt avoiding. Look what you've done. I mean, give them a trial. You know, they don't respond to clothing. They can't get dry, and they say it's okay for check and change. You got it covered. So it's fine for residents to be on a check and change program, but once again, I think it's important if you have explicit language in your chart that will enable you to pass the survey review on the dimensions of individualization and choice, which are high priority areas for our program. So let's move to the next slide. The next slide is voiding patterns. That's in all the survey guidelines that you're supposed to document voiding patterns. And what I'm used to seeing, and in most charts, it's kind of worthless. It's pretty much usually just a 24-hour chart where an aide or somebody marks off the blocks that somebody was wet. You know, 8 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 1 o'clock, whatever. You know, for 24 hours. And then somebody writes a little summary about it. I mean, that fulfills the heart of the guideline, but there's no point in describing a pattern if the resident is not prompted or assisted. I mean, what's the point? I mean, of course, if you don't prompt them or assist them to the toilet, they're going to be wet multiple times in that 24-hour period, but that doesn't tell you anything. What tells you something is that you put them on that 3-day trial, and when you're doing that 3-day trial, as you know, I mean, you will have records every 2 hours of whether they're wet or dry or whether they toileted. Well, that basically gives you a frequency of the continent and incontinent voids. And that will fulfill the obligation to document voiding patterns, with one exception. The one exception is you're not doing this at night. And I don't think you should at this particular point. When we have tried to do it at night before, I think I've told you before, that a lot of patients do not like to be woken up at night. A lot of patients who don't mind being woken up still don't like, even if you go to the bathroom, to use a bedpan, they don't want to get out. So there's a lot more issues. There's a lot more work involved to maintain confidence at night, even if somebody is able to toilet. And to be quite frank, our experience is a lot of patients would prefer, not all, but a lot of patients would prefer not to be woken at night, just to use a highly absorbent diaper. Anyway, the point is, to fulfill this assessment obligation in the survey guidelines of documenting the voiding pattern, I think you're fine during the day with what you're doing now with prompted voiding. That's exactly what it does. But at night, I would have aides just note how often patients are found incontinent or how often they request assistance. So you have a complete 24-hour voiding record, if you will, that will, if somebody looks for it, they can find it. In general, I don't think that the whole idea behind this voiding pattern business is to identify patterns to make things more efficient. In other words, Hopefully they think that if you do this, you can identify. Well, the patient's always lit at 10 o'clock in the morning and then 3 o'clock in the afternoon and 9 o'clock at night or whatever. So therefore, if we know that for sure, and that's the only times we have to get there, or those are the times that we should be for sure and get there. Two things about that. I mean, you can look if you want to try to identify it. My own experience is that just doesn't happen. There's just, the only time that happens is if that's the only time you check them. And then it'll look like a pattern. But if you check them every 2 hours consistently, I haven't seen real distinct patterns like that that you can operate on. So I don't think it's really that terribly useful. My other problem with it is that it really is not, it might look individualized to you, but I think it's not. Now, I think it's a real insult, you know, a slap of dignity if your idea of individualization, well, let's wait till somebody's bladder explodes, and then when it explodes and they're wet, we'll say, oh, that's the time they must need assistance. And that's individualized because we're getting there at the point their bladder can't hold anymore, you know, and they're voiding. I mean, that's pretty demeaning. I mean, I don't think that's individualization. Individualization is you get to somebody regularly and ask them if they want assistance. That's prompt voiding. That's individualization. It's not individualization just to try to trigger your program off the bladder without asking or talking to the patient. So anyway, I don't think it's very useful. Clinically, this voiding pattern business, but nevertheless, I think you have to document it. I just gave you some examples how to do that. Next slide, functional and cognitive issues. They particularly want some description of a patient's functional ability and cognitive ability as it impacts urinary incontinence. What they're looking for is, you know, whether somebody needs assistance to the toilet or not, and how much assistance, with supervision and so on. But the other thing that they're real attentive about looking for, because they're being taught to do that now, and they haven't done this in the past, is that they're being taught to look very carefully as to what the people's justification are, what nursing homes' justifications are for putting people on check and change program or not a toileting program. I mean, it used to be before, the most typical documentation you would see is that a resident is on a check and change program because of dementia or cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's or some words like that. That won't make it anymore. I mean, you know, the new MDS explicitly asks you if you put people on a toileting program or not. So it's not enough just to say that somebody's on a check and change program because we think they're too cognitively impaired to respond to a toileting program. It's not enough. Now, if the patient's comatose and totally unresponsive, then you might say that, and that would be a justification for not even doing the 2 or 3 day trial. But just saying a loose thing like a demented or too cognitively impaired is not enough. So you got to be careful about that. If your chart has a lot of documentation that we're excluding people based on dementia issues, I would be careful and make that much more explicit. Advocates in particular, Alzheimer's Association, advocates in particular are very active right now about the survey process, not accepting that type of documentation to exclude patients from care. The next slide. I got a star by this one as an important thing because I have seen the survey guidelines say that in a good comprehensive assessment, you're supposed to diagnose the type of incontinence that somebody has. They want a label. Some surveyors actually enforce that, some not. I don't think it's very useful. Let me tell you why it's there. If you're going to do an invasive intervention of some sort, surgery for instance, it's vital, obviously, that you document the type of incontinence that surgery is for. And most surgeries are for stress incontinence. So if somebody's going to get a bladder neck extension, there better be some documentation that the person has stress incontinence. If you're using Dipyrran, for instance, that's directed toward urge incontinence, as opposed to calm the bladder. So you better have some documentation of urge incontinence is there. That's what it's for. But some surveyors interpret that you should always do it. I mean, it doesn't matter for prompted voiding and scheduled toileting really what type of incontinence they have, but nevertheless, some surveyors look for it. You can make an estimate of what kind of incontinence that somebody has based on your 3-day trial. I think I told you that, but I'll repeat it again. What I would do if I were you, after the 3-day trial, I would have a line in the chart somewhere that says, based on this 3-day trial, we think the person has stress incontinence because. And one of the examples of stress incontinence would be every time that you lifted the patient or every time that they coughed, there was an expulsion of air. That's what stress incontinence is. I mean, when there's an increase in abdominal pressure because you move somebody or because they cough, they leak. And you can see that when you're doing this 3-day trial. Or you might say, based on this 3-day trial, we think this person has urge incontinence. And how would you diagnose that? Well, this I told you is when somebody tells you they have the sensation that they have to go to the bathroom, but they can't wait. I mean, there's very little delay between the time that they feel they have to go and the time that they really do have to go. So if you see that with a patient, I would say some words in the chart that basically says we think they might have urge incontinence. Mixed incontinence is a combination of both those things, and to be quite frank, that's the most frequent. That's the most frequent category. I mean, most people that we have worked with, and we've even done urological exams, don't have pure stress or pure urge. They have a combination of both those things, stress and urge, and the combination is just what you might think. I mean, they leak when you lift them, and they have trouble waiting from the time of first sensation. Overflow incontinence is hard to diagnose, and this is one of the justifications, really, for a catheter. Looking back to that, overflow incontinence is when somebody's bladder won't empty. And if somebody's bladder won't empty, I mean, they pretty much have continual leakage. And when you put them on the toilet, they do. A lot of times they'll say they try to go to the toilet because it's always full. They can smell very little urine. Very little. You know, even if they try, they just can't empty the bladder. So if here's somebody who tries to go to the bathroom and just can't expel much urine, and it looks like they have, you know, continual leakage, it probably is important to do a post-void residual or refer that person on to somebody. A post-void residual means you ask the patient to void, and then you either use a catheter and empty them to find out how much is there. If there's over 150 cc's or over 200, people think that's too high of a post-void residual. And then something should be done, you know, about that. But that's a medical issue. But you can estimate whether overflow incontinence happens or not by those symptoms during the 3-day trial. Namely, very small amounts of urine that they try to avoid in the toilet and pretty much constant leakage. Functional incontinence, I said urge and stress are the most typical, but functional incontinence really is probably the most typical. Functional incontinence means that these are people who are incontinent simply because they either can't remember to go to the bathroom or they need assistance and they're not getting enough assistance to get there. In other words, there's nothing wrong with the bladder. They have no stress, they have no urge, they have no mix, they have no overflow. The only reason they're incontinent is because they can't get to the bathroom on a timely way or can't remember to do it. Most incontinence really is functional and mixed. And functional you can diagnose if you're working with a patient who gets highly continent when you're doing a constant voiding. And it doesn't look like they leak, it doesn't look like they have urge, they probably have functional incontinence, and that's what I would diagnose just to be safe in their chart for the assessment part. The post-voiding and culture,
next slide.
I already told you to do a post-void or consider it if somebody has retention symptoms, and that's also the justification for a catheter. You might consider, you know, if it's a new patient and you don't know them, you might consider doing a clean catch and a dipstick analysis to see if they have a UTI or not. Now, be careful with that a little bit, because somebody can have high bacteria, and if they don't have any other symptoms, no burning, no fever, or whatever, they probably don't have UTI, and you don't have to do anything with it. But a dipstick will tell you something, like whether there's hematuria, blood in the urine, just few of some other things that you can document in the chart. When a patient is new and you don't know them, that will cover yourself for whether or not you're considering whether the person has urinary tract infections or not. It's a fairly simple, cheap thing to do. This clean catch dipstick analysis. It doesn't require catheterization. It doesn't require sending something to a lab. It's something you can do pretty briefly yourself. Now, once again, you can do this during the test. Well, I do it during the 3-day trial. I mean, at the point where you know where somebody will try to void for you, I clean them up and try to catch the void of your urine. I clean receptacle called Duro dipstick analysis, Duro dipstick on it right then to get at the to get the urinary tract infection issue. All right, the next slide. The next slide is on staffing. This, I think, is one of the most important issues that there is that you should consider in terms of how to do prompted voiding. We've talked about it to some extent. We're going to talk about it more today, and I'm going to ask your opinion about it. But let's review. Here's two key points for you to remember from an aid perspective. To draw the patient through prompted voiding, if you do it right, takes 5 to 10 minutes per episode. Well, what I mean doing it right, I mean just not putting them on the toilet and leaving them there. I mean talking to them and not hurting them, giving them enough time to void. That takes 5 to 10 minutes per episode. We've timed it over and over again. On the other hand, simply changing an incontinent patient takes only 3 to 5 minutes. And it doesn't have to be as timely as prompted voiding. I mean, you can change somebody whenever you have time. If it's 1 o'clock, you're just coming off your break, going to lunch or whatever, you don't have to worry about whether to get there in time to take somebody to the toilet. I mean, if they're wet to the wet, 15, 20, 30 minutes, what difference does it make? You don't have to really schedule yourself and organize yourself to get there on a timely basis for changing. So there's a natural tendency for direct care staff or aides to really prefer or to find it easier. Find it easier to just change patients after they're wet versus preventing residents' wetness by taking them to the toilet. And that's why you'll see periodically, aides telling people who have to go to the toilet, just use your diaper. Or just wait until I have time. Unfortunately, you do hear those things. Hopefully, you'll never let a surveyor hear you say those things or somebody say those things. But they're said. And they're documented in multiple surveys that surveyors hear, but we hear them all the time. And the reason for it is there's no way around it. It takes more time and effort to keep people dry who are mobility dependent and somewhat demented, hard to work with. It takes more time to keep those people dry through a toileting program, whether it's scheduled toileting or prompted voiding, than it does through a changing program. So what's the recommendation? Now, we've gone through this over and over again, so the recommendation pretty much is, this is the next slide, that one aide can only do 4 prompted voiding residents at max, assuming that they're working with a load of 8 to 10 patients. I don't know what your staffing ratios are, but in most homes, a ratio of one aide to 8 to 10 patients comes close to what the average is. So if you're working with, say, 8 people, let's just say 8, what I'm saying to you is that if there are 4 patients who are good for prompted voiding, that's about all that aide is going to be able to do, 2 per hour. If you do 2 per hour, every other hour, 4 patients, you do 2 at 8, 2 at 9, 2 at 10, 2 at 11, and so on. If that's the case, you're spending about 20 minutes, not counting travel time. Travel time to get there, you're spending about 20 minutes on just those patients, for prompted voiding. There's only 60 minutes in an hour. And you have 4 other patients if you're low as 8. I mean, you have 4 other patients you have to do something with. So in our view, you're really pressing the envelope if you expect somebody to be able to take care of more than 4 prompted voiding patients on a very regular and consistent basis if they're working with a load of 8 to 10 patients. Now, obviously, if they have a less load than that, if they only work, we really bank, I always advocate that the best ratio for nursing homes to try to strive for, even though I know you're not paid enough to do it, is a ratio of about one aide to five to six patients. In that case, if you have one aide to five to six patients, you should be able to take care of everybody who needs prompt boarding assistance on a consistent basis. But most patients don't have that, so the places don't have that. So if you only have eight to ten, I think you can only do four prompt boarding residents at max, and that's all you should assign your aides. However, I'm willing to be proven wrong. I mean, I would be interested in what your nursing home's experience is. I mean, as you get into this and as you do it, I mean, I think you should be attentive to the fact that my view is that only one aide can take care of four patients, but maybe you have some method in place where you can do more than that. If that's the case, I would love to hear about it, so I'd love to hear your opinion about it. In general, we welcome comments and questions, suggestions about anything, but that in particular, the staffing issue, I think is extraordinarily important. I would really benefit myself from hearing about your experience and what you think the staffing ratio should be to do prompt voiding in combination with everything else you have to do with patients. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Annie for more comments, questions, or suggestions. Annie?
All right. Well, we'll stop right there.